You're listening to episode 24 of the Leadership Journey podcast with me, your host, Alan Wilson. Each episode of the podcast gives you the opportunity to reflect on some of the stories and lessons that make up a leadership journey. You can subscribe to the Leadership Journey podcast on iTunes, and you can even leave a review. This week, I'm speaking to Ken McBride. Ken retired just about a year ago after over 35 years as a Presbyterian minister, most of that time spent in Orangefield Presbyterian in East Belfast. In this episode, Ken talks about his childhood faith. He talks about his initial resistance to ministry and the institution of the church, and about the challenge as a self-confessed talker of realising that he needed to listen. He also talks about meeting his wife and about their whirlwind romance. Enjoy the podcast. Well, Ken, welcome to the Leadership Journey podcast. We've got a lot of Kens from Hollywood or the Hollywood area popping up. Just the past couple of weeks, we've been talking to Ken Clark, whom I think you know quite well.
Yes, indeed.
Was there a story about a year ago about a retirement do? There were quite a lot of Kens turned up at this.
Yes. When we retired, whether the elders trusted me fully to speak properly on the last Sunday or not, I don't know, but they thought it would be good to have some colleagues coming to commend the future, both me and the church, to God. And so we came up with the three Kenners, Ken Clark, Ken Yule, and myself, were all involved. And the idea was that Ken Yule would have a word from God for the congregation mm-hmm. after 32 years of my ministry, as they faced a future that was going to be very different. And the idea was that Ken or Fanta Clark would say something to Barbara and myself as we faced retirement, which Ken Clark called refirement.
Yeah, he's given out stickers. I don't know if you got one. I should have brought one of his stickers for you.
I got the sticker.
You got one?
Yes. I've been stickered by Fanta Clark.
So. And then you were the other one. So what did you get to speak about?
Well, I tried to say something very simple at the end, and what I wanted to do and did was show a video of Derek Redmond running in the 2000 Barcelona Olympics. Mm-hmm. And if you remember that, he was running in the finals and fell down with a hamstring injury mm-hmm. and tried to get up to finish the race and kept limping. And out of the stands came this man who the security people tried to swat away. And he brushed past them all and put his arms around his son. And he said, "You don't have to do this." But Derek said, "I do." So the father helped the son limp to the finish line. Uh-huh. And the crowds leapt to their feet and applauded and cheered the fact that he had finished. And what I really wanted to leave the congregation with, no matter what they learned or didn't learn from my preaching, was this was a picture of God who does not look from the stands dispassionately upon our lives, but comes down to the field and helps us limp to the finishing line.
Wow.
And I wanted to leave the people in Orangefield just with that image of God who would be with them and would help them get to that finishing line.
That's great. Of heaven. That's super. That's almost a year ago.
Yes, indeed.
So a year of retirement, and we're sitting here. I'm looking out the window. We should be able to see the mountains of Mourne, but we can't because it's one of those days. But what has retirement been like? Has that been a big shock for you to be away from the busyness of a fairly large church?
I think there's been one or two moments where I, particularly in the evenings, where I would have been used to being out more, mm-hmm. and I've said to my wife, Barbara, what are we going to do now? But I have to say that very quickly, and with Ken Clark's refirement in my in my ears, very quickly we've got into a routine. We've got involved in doing a lot of things in our local church here in Newcastle, doing a little part-time job up in Grantshire Presbyterian Church a couple of afternoons a week. And I've not yet had time to be bored, but I'm also appreciating just not having that responsibility.
Yeah.
I literally attended hundreds of meetings a year, and it's a joy to be able to take time to be with people to a greater extent than I was able to do in ministry, and to have no agenda, but just to listen to people, and interestingly, we find people here in Newcastle very open with Barbara and I, sharing their stories, their hurts, their fears, mm-hmm. and asking us to pray for them. And mm-hmm. so, we have settled almost seamlessly into retirement, mm-hmm. And enjoying every moment so far.
Mm-hmm. You were mentioning actually that you and Barbara had begun to develop prayer ministry in the church that you're now part of here in Newcastle.
Yes, both of us did some training with Derek McKelvey, the course that he runs. He seems to be hundreds of people have gone through his Kairos training course. And we discovered that there have been five people in Newcastle who have done that course as well. And so the prayer action team in the church approached Barbara and I and said, would we be interested in helping coordinate prayer ministry? Mm-hmm. So we're hoping to launch in the middle of June.
Great.
And we're very privileged to be asked to do that. Mm-hmm. And it's another step forward for Newcastle. Mm-hmm. We're trying to make prayer more central. We mm-hmm. just started a new prayer meeting last Wednesday called NPC Central. And so, yes, we're getting involved in that way.
Right, good. So 32 years in Orangefield. Before that, a couple of other churches that you worked with?
Yes, going backwards in chronological order, I was 4 years in a triple point charge in County Tyrone. Before that, I did 3 years as an assistant in Railway Street in Lisburn, mm-hmm. And then obviously my training in mm-hmm. Theological College. Yeah. So really, the vast majority of ministry in the 32 years in Orangefield.
Yeah. Well, as you look back, going back even before your training and your involvement in those roles as a minister, do you see, looking back, any indicators that is the likely path that your life was going to take?
Not very many. I remember one of the big influences in my life in church was Christian Endeavour. That used to frighten the life out of me when they did chain prayer, and inevitably somebody three away from me would pray what I'd been planning.
All right, so this is where you sit in a circle and the person beside you prays, and then you pray and it goes on.
Somebody beside me would pray what I was going to pray, and it never occurred to me as a 10-year-old or whatever that I could pray the same prayer. And what it did for us was to give a real confidence in praying aloud in public. Mm-hmm. But my first attempt at leadership, I have to say, ended in abject failure, because when I was 10, I was asked to be treasurer of Christian Endeavour.
At 10?
And at the end of a year, the accounts were £5 out. And that doesn't sound a lot of money, but when your pocket money is like 50 pence, or whatever it was in those days, it's a lot of money. So at the end of the year, I put £5 into the accounts and resigned as treasurer.
Oh, goodness.
And I met a man some years later who was training for the ministry, and he said, Ken, he says, I thought when you resigned from being treasurer of Christian Endeavour, you'd given up the faith. I said, no, I just couldn't count. So that was an abject failure. But yes, I suppose where I began to have seeds of leadership was we ended up forming a band that went around doing a lot of coffee bar work.
Okay, what was it called?
Oh, I would prefer not to tell
you. All right, okay. Just in case anybody listening remembers
it. We called it Christian, which sounds so twee.
Christian,
yes.
Right, okay.
And people didn't know how to introduce us. And in fact, I think there was a band later on called The Christians, but people used to introduce it. Tonight we have singing The Christians. And, but I suppose it gave part of our heart. But even there, we ended up with a group where there were about 10 or 12 of us. Mm-hmm. And some were singers and some were musicians and some were doing prayer letters and stuff. And we had about 70 prayer partners. And I suppose it was a kind of natural thing for me to want to organise. Uh-huh. And we went into coffee bars and went to youth services and churches. We ended up doing a thing that was very grandiosely called by ourselves apologetics, but we thought nobody'd understand what that meant, so rather badly we called it Folk and Words.
We
did a series of things. We'd take it, the most common thing, say, was love.
Yeah.
And we'd start off with songs in the charts like Frankie and Johnny Were Lovers or The Beatles, All You Need Is Love. But then we began to weave that through into what the Bible understood by love and what the cross represented. And it used to be that in those things that somebody had to do a speaking slot, mm-hmm. and it usually fell to me to do. So there was kind of similar things in terms of mm-hmm. organisation, in terms of speaking. And I think through that some people began to say, would you consider going into mm-hmm. the ministry? Mm-hmm. And my immediate response was no way. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to do that.
Why?
I looked upon the institution, and I always have done, and I always still do, with a great deal of suspicion and dislike. I don't like institutions. Mm-hmm. I think they're like towns and cities. I think mm-hmm. there's something inherently bad about them. You know, lots of people congregating together and having a busy lifestyle and a rushed way of doing things and losing contact with their roots. But institutions sometimes, in my view, stifle the immediacy of experience and ability to do things. I was always the kind of person, if I wanted to do something, wanted to go out and do it and not have to wait for elders and committees and, you know, people to meet uh-huh. and discuss and come back with mm-hmm. various things. I wanted to get up and do.
Okay. Had you grown up in a Presbyterian setting?
Oh, all my life.
Yeah.
All my life. And for which I'm exceptionally grateful, because I think what it gave to me was a very strong biblical base. And I always belonged to an evangelical church. Uh-huh. Where the gospel had a high priority and preaching was relevant and good. And therefore that grounding was very important to me. But I my worry about institutions is the tendency to micromanage mm-hmm. Situations and churches. And I just think sometimes we need to be more readily able to respond quickly to what the Spirit is saying mm-hmm, to the church mm-hmm. And just to go and do mm-hmm. rather than we love to debate and talk. And I mean, I've spent my life in meetings, and it kind of confirms my suspicion that we're more ready to talk than mm-hmm. to do. Mm-hmm. And my heart would have been, let's do and mm-hmm. talk later if necessary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But when you were growing up, though, you weren't aware of all of that.
You were aware,
you just felt this was a good environment. You were encouraged spiritually. When did you come to faith then?
Well, I have no idea when I became a Christian. I know at the age of 8, somebody in a Good News Club mm-hmm. Put a picture in front of me with mm-hmm. a little parcel tied with coloured ribbon. And it said underneath it, God's gift of salvation, and a wee line, your name. And, uh-huh. you know, so I signed the card. Uh-huh. But I really don't remember not being a Christian.
Yeah.
Having been brought up in a Christian home, my parents taught me to pray mm-hmm. every night. And they would have taught me little prayers like, and I still remember, Lord, here I do lie down to sleep. I give my soul to thee to keep. Wake I may, wake I never, I pray thee, Lord, to keep my soul forever. Uh-huh. And so my parents taught me to pray, they taught me to read the Bible, and I don't ever remember not being a Christian, but 8 uh-huh. years of age was the first time
sure.
where I would say, looking back on it, I gave the little I knew of myself to the little I knew of God, uh-huh. and it's been a constant journey ever since.
I gave the little I knew of myself to the little I knew of God,
yes.
that's been a constant journey ever since. I think it's a very nice way of describing, you know, probably there are lots of people, I think in this country, there are lots of people mm-hmm. who came to faith when they were very young. I know I was a child, I was 7. And I think that's a very good way to put it. And it's mm-hmm. an encouragement, I think, to realise that there's a lot of growth that needs to happen
yes.
and a lot of understanding that needs to come yeah. about.
Well, I used to be jealous of people who had, you know, great testimonies,
yeah.
you know, who we had a guy in school who came to faith and he had been out in the streets drunk and his parents used to have to drive and pick him up in a car at the edge of a footpath. And when he came to faith and he was playing for the first 15, he made a big impact in church mm-hmm. and in school. And I used to say, oh, Lord, I wish I had a testimony like that. and so jealous of those kind of things. But But I went through a period of doubt in my early 20s, just after starting university. And bizarrely, the thing that brought me out of that doubt was the most famous verse in the Bible, John 3:16, where somebody had said to me, whenever it says God so loved the world, put your name in the in place of the world God so loved Ken, that he gave his only son, etc. And that seemed to turn me around from a period of depression and doubt. And at that stage, and I can't even remember the specifics, but at that stage with that well-known verse, God said to me, don't ever doubt your faith again. And I never have. I have doubted my sanctification sometimes, but never that I'm a Christian.
What sort of a nurturing environment was it then for you as a young person?
Well, I've already mentioned that home was a big factor in that. I was encouraged in my Christian faith. I was sent to church. I was given an example of prayer and Bible reading. And I well remember my father used to kneel at the side of the bed, put his elbows in the bed, and I'd see him praying. But the other big thing was church and Sunday school and Christian Endeavour with great people there who were leaders by example, but also enthusiastic about the faith and very keen to take an interest in young people. I had the other great influence of school and Scripture Union. So many Christian friends at school. It was unbelievable. Sullivan Upper in Hollywood was an amazing place way back in my childhood, and probably still is. And the other thing was the likes of Crusaders Bible Class and inter-schools camps. And in all these things, I had a huge amount of Christian input into my life.
Okay, let's go back to the band then, and people are starting to say to you, we think you should be looking at going in the ministry, which probably was the last thing that you really wanted to do. Talk through the transition then. How did you get from that resistance to ending up going for training and getting into the Presbyterian Church?
Well, in my final year at university, my first degree was in English. In my final year, I got a job in the civil service and stayed on for 18 months to try and work my way through, am I called to ministry? What's that look like? Is there another alternative route? And I applied for a number of jobs. First of all, I felt a strong call to ministry of some kind. Through reading Alan Redpath's commentary on Nehemiah, Victorious Christian Service. And that was something that just fired me up for saying, I want to serve God, I want to serve him in Christian ministry, but not necessarily the church. And I tried a number of job applications to mission organisations, and uniformly they came back and said, we would be interested in you, but only if you had some experience of pastoral ministry. So I thought, how do I get experience of pastoral ministry? Oh, I know, I'll apply for the Presbyterian ministry. I went to my minister and talked about that, and he wasn't discouraging, went through the kind of process of interview and so forth. And so I guess I really went not necessarily thinking, you know what, I'll end up as a Presbyterian minister. But once I got into college, which of course they were expecting you'd go into the ministry of the church, with that, it then seemed a more logical thing to do, and maybe not such a bad idea.
Was there some point though that you'd wanted to be a social worker?
Yes, absolutely.
What happened about that?
When I started Queen's, my English degree in second year became combined with a social work option. At the end of that second year, having completed all my coursework as I should have done, they came back to me and said they'd made a mistake, that they had not properly admitted me to the course. Now, the course meant that I, instead of doing honours, did a basic English degree with a 2-year social work qualification into it. And my intention at that stage was to be a student counsellor, which I thought was a pretty cool thing to do. You know, we'd hang around with students in coffee shops and, you know, I've measured out my life in coffee spoons, as T.S. Eliot said. It seemed to me that the kind of cool thing to do. And what I guess I was really doing was saying, God, I'm sure you'll be really happy with me because I want to work full time and I'm going to be a student counsellor, so bless me. And then when I was asked to go back at the end of my degree and do a 2-year qualification social work, that didn't appeal at all. I didn't want to do any more studying. And I certainly at that stage didn't want to study theology. So that's why I really took that 18 months of the extended summer job.
Were you disappointed or surprised that God didn't take your offer more seriously?
I think initially I was more surprised than disappointed. It was like being brought up short and said, And as I prayed about it, I began to realise that what was important was not me saying to God, I'm going to do this for you, aren't you pleased? But actually to flip that around and say, God, what do you want me to do? And when I began to get that sense that people began saying to me, you should go into the ministry, that then made me feel uncomfortable because I didn't want to wear a uniform. I didn't want to wear a clerical collar. I didn't want to wear robes. I didn't want to be part of that kind of what I perceived as a stuffy institution. And this partly, you know, when we played in the band, I remember one time singing at a youth service and we sang a first song and the congregation applauded. At the end of that, the minister looked at the congregation most sternly and he said, I'd remind you, he said, that you're in the house of God. And when these young people next sing, do not applaud. And we got up and sang our second song. There was a pregnant pause and then huge round of applause. And I think that said to me, you know, those were the days in the late 60s, you know, where guitars weren't allowed in churches and, you know, what we were doing seemed to be radical. And probably for that kind of reason, I felt, oh, the institution's a stuffy thing I don't want to be involved in. So it was quite a surprise when God, when I inverted my thinking, said, Lord, what do you want me to do? And God said, I want you there where you least want to go at the moment. That was a shock, but one that, yeah, it took a while to get over. And actually it took well into my theological training to get over that.
Was that quite a, would you say that's quite a significant thing that you learned then about your relationship with God?
Probably listening to this interview, you can tell I talk a lot. And the idea that suddenly God might want me to stop talking and start listening was a real big transition. And then I thought, well, how do I start listening to God? I've got to read his word, I've got to talk to others, and I've got to listen to what others say. And of course, part of the listening to what others say was advice. We think you should go into the ministry.
What about training then? You know, because you're obviously now in an institution, a training institution, and it's the training institution of the institution. So what was that like? Were you a bit of a revolutionary in there?
I hated it at first. We had some tremendous lecturers and some who we felt challenged us about our faith, possibly because, well, in the arrogance of youth, you sometimes thought, can these men have faith at all? But I remember one lecturer who I believe was a universalist who we couldn't understand his support for mission. So he said, oh, mission is telling people who don't know they're saved that they are. And of course, you know, a lot of us responded against that. But there would have been, I think, in our denomination at that time, quite a schism between evangelicals and liberals. Maybe I went in at a time when more evangelical students were starting to come into the college.
This is what, mid-70s, early 70s?
Yes, late 70s.
Late 70s, okay.
But yeah, sort of 75 onwards. But I hated the suddenly being thrust into learning Hebrew and Greek and two new languages. And I wasn't very good, hadn't a huge facility for new languages. And I thought there were more important things to learn. Again, part of the arrogance of youth. But I think too, I just found the whole training for ministry was a very heavy kind of thing. And, you know, when you're young, you just want to get out and do it. Mm-hmm. You don't want to have to wait for the tools. But I think when I look back from the end of theological training, I'm very grateful that it gave me tools for understanding the Bible, mm-hmm. for expounding the scriptures, and for working in ministry. Mm-hmm. It didn't equip me hugely for leading in the church, nor did it equip me hugely for developing my own spiritual life. Mm-hmm. But there were a lot of benefits for which I'm grateful.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned Hebrew and Greek. Was there not a story about having a little bit of difficulty with a Greek exam?
Oh, thank you for that, Alan. Yes, I have to say.
But probably. I know there's a story behind it. There's a story, though, isn't there? Is there not a story that you got?
Well, yeah, there's a story there. I failed Greek at the end of first year was then to do the resit in the summer, but I was doing a summer assistantship, and the boss I had gone off to Donegal, where there was no telephone contact, uh-huh. nothing going on, and the day or two after he'd left, there was a funeral or death, and then somebody came who wanted to be married, whose parents felt they shouldn't get married, and it was a mixed marriage, and studying for Greek didn't seem that important, and the end result was I failed my resit, mm-hmm. and then was thrown out of theological college for a year until I got the resit.
Well, sorry to embarrass you with this, but I know there's a good ending to the story.
That meant I was a year longer in my home church than I otherwise would have been, because then I would have been into an assistantship in a way, and mm-hmm. so forth. And in that extra year, we ran a youth camp, and we needed a nurse, and I asked around some of my friends, you know, anybody who might be interested in coming, and somebody suggested this girl, Barbara Gray, and we invited her along to be our nurse at the youth camp in Moffat in Scotland, and I didn't like her and she didn't like me, but after the camp somehow we ended up meeting each other again, and I decided to ask her out. And with no serious intention whatsoever, within 2 weeks we were planning the wedding. Well, and to this day we don't know, did she ask me or did I ask her? But we just started planning the wedding. So technically, if I hadn't failed my Greek recess,
well, there you go.
I wouldn't have met her. Now, sovereignty of God aside, but technically I wouldn't have been on that youth camp. So yes, there was God purposes good even out of bad things.
And if you'd had your own way, you'd have been a social worker. And you never would have been learning Greek at all. So absolutely. Who knows the course that life takes, the providence of God. That then led to, well, you've been married for how many years now?
Coming up to 41 years.
Yeah. Terrific. And then in terms of work, after college, into an assistantship. I think you said it was in Lisburn.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. I had 3 years in the assistantship there. Again, a very learning experience. And sometimes positive and sometimes negative. Then into first charge, which was, you're thrust into your first charge. And I have to say, it was a triple point charge. First church time.
Triple point Albany. Meaning three
congregations
in one area.
Minister.
Yeah. I think actually I drove up past that area a few months ago, and you'd mentioned the names of them before, and yeah. I spotted that. Yeah.
Well, I guess I made all my mistakes there. They used to laugh at me. That Mr. McBride doesn't know what a springing heifer is, and don't ask me what it is because I still don't know. This tiny ministering in the country.
It's a very rural area.
Oh, very much. Yeah, so. Yeah. It's some of the highest agricultural land in Northern Ireland, uh-huh. actually. And so I made all my mistakes there. Well, not all of them, but if you multiply the number of mistakes you can make in 4 years, it was a huge amount. That was a good preparation for the next
stage. How did you see God working, though, during the time?
We saw the three churches between them had maybe 180 families. Mm-hmm. And in that period, I saw maybe 70 people coming to faith out of the congregations.
In 4 years.
And and that was a huge impact mm-hmm. on the congregations. And in fact, I think those ministering there today would say that many of the leaders of that mm-hmm. church who are now in their mid-30s, 40s, mm-hmm. were people who had come to faith mm-hmm. In that time. Where I got very frustrated was I felt that people were not prepared for discipleship. Mm-hmm. And that might have been my fault, and maybe didn't know how to do it. But I felt that there was a lack of willingness sometimes for people to share that they had come to faith. And I remember challenging one man. I said, why don't you tell your neighbours, friends, you've come to faith? And he said, oh, Mr. McBride, you might have to buy a heifer from so-and-so, and I wouldn't want to offend them, you know. And I thought, well, goodness, you know, we've got more important news than buying cattle. And so part of that unsettlement led to me thinking, I need to move. Mm-hmm. But at that stage, and this was a big transition, there was a point where, for a whole variety of reasons, I desperately wanted out. But I felt God saying to me, no, you need to surrender this. And that's been a common theme mm-hmm. in my life, this idea of surrendering our lives on the altar mm-hmm. so that the life we live is no longer ours, but mm-hmm. Christ's. And I remember coming to a point and saying, God, I want desperately to be out of this situation and in a new church. But if you want me to stay, I'm willing to stay. It's a bit like relearning the social work to mm-hmm. ministry thing. Mm-hmm. God's not what I want, but what you want. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I came to that point of what I would call surrender, three opportunities immediately presented themselves mm-hmm. to leave. And one of them was Orangefield. Mm-hmm. At that stage, I had no idea mm-hmm. that I'd spend the rest of my ordained mm-hmm. paid ministry. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's a good point for us just to we'll hit the pause button there for this week, right. and we'll pick up next week and talk about Orangefield, how you came to be there. Because if there's three people are looking for you to come, yeah. How come it was Orangefield? How does God lead in those times of transition? And we'll explore that, and then we'll talk about some of the things that you learned along the course of your ministry in Orangefield. Mm-hmm. All right, so thanks for being with us, and we'll talk again soon.
Thanks for taking the time to listen to this episode of the Leadership Journey podcast, and thanks to Ken for taking the time to talk to us. Ken will be back next week. In the meantime, have a good week, and God bless you.